Good morning, everyone, and welcome to BT Centre. It's a real privilege to be able to speak to you today, and a very exciting opportunity as well, because I think this is one of the first times we've had an investor event around digital impact and sustainability, which is a really, really important theme for this company. It's important not just to our reputation, but also fundamentally to our strategy and growth plan. And today, we're going to talk about that in some detail. So I'm going to start by taking you through the agenda. First of all, I'll share how our D, I, and S agenda is a key part of the strategy. So I'll share how it fits within the strategic framework. Then I'm delighted that Jasmine Whitbread, who's been a board member for 7 years, Jim, has been on the group board for 7 years, has been working with us in the sustainability area for longer than that. And has recently taken over the chair of our CSRB, which is the committee of the board that oversees this area. And Jasmine's going to bring some of her own thoughts to bear on the discussion. Andy Wales, who leads our efforts overall on digital impact and sustainability, and he's going to introduce the session. Maura Oliver, who runs Human Rights and Digital Human and Digital Rights Program, will then talk to us about our efforts in that area. Candice Cross will cover our inclusion and diversity agenda. And then finally, Gabrielle Junior is going to update you on the progress we've made around climate change and our impact on particularly the carbon footprint of the company. So there'll be time for Q&A at the end with Jasmine, Ed Petter, who knows our group comms director, Mark Lilliard, who heads up IR, and Andy and his team right at the end. Very good. So I'm going to start with the strategy, and this is a slide that we talk to every quarter that really sets out our overall strategy. Our vision is all about leadership in converged connectivity. Our goal is about driving sustainable value, growth and value. And the key components, the pillars of the strategy are around differentiated customer experience, integrated network leadership, and transforming our operating model. All of that's critically important, but I want to really focus on the purpose, which is not something we spend much time on in quarterly results, but ultimately it is the line, it is the principle that defines almost everything we do in the company, both the long-term strategic vision, but also people's actions on a day-to-day basis. So this purpose is about using the power of communications to make a better world. The overriding thought that really directs us on every single thing we do. So it's fundamental to our strategy, and it shapes every single decision. Now today, we're going to talk about a number of things, and I'm going to start by just referencing Building a Better Tomorrow for Our People, and that's Citizens Across the UK. Three things in particular we'll touch on: digital skills for the next generation, helping customers reduce their carbon emissions, and then talking about the impact we're making around human rights. We'll talk about our impact for the business agenda in terms of how building digital improves productivity, which is a long-running challenge, I think, for the UK. And we'll also talk about the impact we're having for BT. Their ability to attract and retain a diverse talent pool and to create demand for the new products that we're launching, particularly in this space. Now, the purpose, our purpose, is the unifying force backed by action that brings everything together and allows us to deliver the outcomes we're looking for. And before we go into the forward-looking agenda, I want to look back and at some of the highlights of the last few years. I'm going to start with Barefoot. So Barefoot is the challenge, is the alliance we have with the British Computer Society, a partnership that is taking the digital skills agenda into primary school. It's been going for 3 or 4 years now. We now support over 55% of primary schools, helping to teach the ICT agenda that's now part of the core curriculum in the, I think it's grade 7, or at the primary school curriculum. trained with colleagues across BC, over 63,000 teachers across the UK, leveraging the volunteering power of BC across the whole of the United Kingdom. And we've just recently passed the 2 million school child to be taught through this mechanism, which is, I think, extremely powerful. Our goal is to get to all 5 million by the end of 2020, but I think we're well on the way to achieving that. But the second thing I wanted to talk about is really our work in human rights and tackling modern slavery. Now, this is a topic of growing concern, a global issue, not just an issue outside of the UK. You see firsthand, I'm sure, that it exists as a problem here in the UK as well. From a regulatory perspective, it's getting more fit, and obviously it's a priority for the Prime Minister. We've partnered with a company, a charity called Unseen, to create the UK's modern slavery helpline. We've developed an app with them to more easily report potential cases when people come across them around the UK. On gender equality, we've done a lot of work to really promote women in tech, both internally and externally. So externally, we'll talk about our partnership with Code First Girls. This provides free full-time training for coding from beginners to junior software developers over a four-month period. If you go through this program, we guarantee that you'll have an interview with BC Technology on completion. That's one example. I think the other one that's really important worth pointing out is the work we've been doing on a tech women program, where hundreds of women have joined this program across BC, promoting technical skills and technical career pathways through the organisation, really allowing us to tap into a very powerful but underrepresented part of the workforce and really improve the diversity and the size of the pool of skills that we've got within the company. This is an award-winning program. We'll talk more about this and give you more detail later, but it's something we're really, really proud of. I think finally on climate action, and this is, I think, the part of the program that's been going the longest, but in many ways it's been the part of the program that is, I think, most groundbreaking and gives us worldwide benefits, I think, in terms of our reputation. So we first established a carbon reduction target back in 1992. In 2008, we were one of the first companies in the world to set an 80% target in the cut of our carbon emissions, which we achieved 4 years early. We've recently announced a new net zero carbon emissions goal that will be net zero by 2045. And yesterday we announced two new energy deals, which means not just BC, but EE within BC is now powered by 100% renewable electricity. So, in closing, BC has a long, incredible history, I think, in this area. You know, this is part of the DNA of the company. We've not just come to this recently. You'll find that colleagues across the business do and believe in everything around the social purpose agenda instinctively and intuitively. It is a great way to build our business, but it has challenges and opportunities, and you'll see us talk about those more in more detail today. And with that, I'm delighted to have Jasmine here to share her views on what this means, not just for BC, but businesses across the UK. Jasmine.
Thank you very much, Gavin, and welcome. It's great to be here with Gavin and with all of you, so thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And today we're going to hear more from the team about what's going to get us ready for tomorrow, but before we get on to that, I just wanted to take a moment to look at and explain the governance structure that we have in place around this issue. So I have been on the BC board, as Gavin said, for over 7 years, and actually involved in this committee for just longer than that. I took over the chairmanship of this committee just over a year ago, and I'm delighted that I have Jan, our chairman, on the committee with us, and also our chief executive, Gavin, as well as some other executives here. And also, interestingly, the model that we have is it includes three external independent members. So DC kind of takes a hybrid approach. Some companies have purely advisory boards made up of external experts, and other companies go for the purely internal committee approach. By bringing the best of both of those together, I think we result in a committee that brings a good amount of experience and challenge to this really important area, overseeing the kind of strategy and operations of our of the sustainability and the digital impact of our company. So we meet four times a year, and we take a really broad overview of the range of social and sustainability related opportunities the organisation faces. We also do a field trip once a year. I've been on many of those, and including going to see some of that fantastic work that Gavin talked about in the Barefoot programme in primary schools around the country. So you heard from Gavin about our purpose, which is to use the power of communication to make a better world. And for me, that's about building a world where people are prepared for the challenges that tomorrow brings. And I think that as we consider what those are, it's good to elevate four key challenges. First of all, on digital skills, by 2022, the UK will need 500,000 more workers in the digital industry. And to help you imagine the scale of that, that is 10 times the number of computer science graduates that the UK produced in the last three times the number of computer science graduates that the UK produced in the last 10 years. So that is a large number, and it's only 3 years away. So quite a challenge that we've taken on. On gender, it's a subset, really, of the issue, because by 2022, as things stand, only 30% of that digital workforce will be women. So that's a pipeline issue that we need to get on top of as soon as possible. The third challenge I think it's worth elevating is around human rights. And this is obviously a particularly important theme, as Gavin said, for the Prime Minister, the government generally, for business and for society. And you know, it's estimated that 40 million people around the world are currently in some form of slavery. And lastly, on climate, we're already seeing, aren't we, sort of the increasingly unpredictable patterns of weather and the impact that this is having around the world. And the recent reports really demonstrate the challenges ahead. However, each of these challenges also represents a leadership opportunity for the UK and for BC. So BC does have an opportunity to make a meaningful contribution on digital skills. We have a strong foothold in UK's primary schools. We have the partners, the reach, and the commitment to really make a difference. And the focus in this area can also directly feed the diverse pool of talent that's needed, both now and in the future, as all jobs become digital jobs. And as we think about human and digital rights, I think there's a key role the tech sector can play in combating issues like modern slavery. And finally, the opportunity to build from a position of strength. As Gavin said, I think DC was already recognised as ahead of its own when I became involved with the organisation nearly a decade ago. And you know, where the ICT sector has huge opportunities to enable rapid decarbonisation. So to talk about all of these areas further, I'm handing over to Andy and the team, and we'll be joining you for questions.
Thank you, Jasmine. Thanks, Gavin. A welcome from me, and also a warm welcome, not just to those in the room, but those who are joining through the webcast and also on the telephone. We'll make sure when it comes to questions later that we probably cover those groups. There's probably, I think, 30 or 40 people dialing in different ways from outside. So I joined BP just under 6 months ago. I came from the beer sector, so upgrading to telco, from 10 years at SAP Miller and AB InBev. And there were two things in particular that attracted me to come to BT. The first was its long leadership in sustainability. In fact, chatting with Seb from Web just before, jog my memory, that when I started a Masters in Sustainability Leadership 20 years ago, ago, not slightly more. The very first thing I did on my first day was to head up to the top of BT Tower for a session about how video conferencing would reduce carbon emissions and grow the business. So I've been listening for a very long time, and it's pretty successful, I think. So there's the past kind of leadership, but there's also the future opportunity. And that's where BT, as a leader in digital, and particularly some of the work we'll talk around in digital skills, is so critically important. So let me just first introduce a framework that I find quite helpful. It's from Accenture. I've used it in a few places. When we understand how a business can step up its leadership on managing and supporting both environmental and social issues in the context of the business's strategy. So first, on the left, as you look at the slide, you know, some companies can take a simple risk mitigation approach. You know, cover the core issues in a particular risk mitigating way and stop there. You know, companies sometimes then go beyond that and actually look for the reputation side of that and look to build reputation through some of the causes they align with. And sometimes they're causes that connect to their core business, and sometimes they're not. The third stage, and this is where I think BT is probably at the moment, is then going beyond that and having programs of engagement across the business and externally that support the strategy, support the business objectives that are the kind of core to the business, and our work on climate, our work on diversity and inclusion, I think are very good examples of that. But where I'd like BT to go is to the right-hand side of that slide, as you look at it, which is around the catalytic change that we can help drive with other partners for the challenges that society faces. And in particular for the UK, productivity is an immense challenge. And productivity has digital skills as one of the biggest parts of the solution. And so for us, that's what I'd like us to get, building and capitalising partnerships that solve big problems in society. And one of the things we're going to do to get there is really sharpen the areas that we work on and how we execute against our digital impact and sustainability strategy. So Jasmine and Gavin talked about that purpose at the top of the slide there. And we've now identified a number of core issues that we will lead on to help us deliver against that purpose. The first is by improving access to digital skills, and in particular, targeted digital support for our customers at key stages of their life. I'll talk more about that in a moment. Second, then human and digital rights. There are a significant set of issues that society faces that are also risks for BT, as well as opportunities for them. Moira will talk through that. The third is climate change and environment, and we have been the leading global telco on climate, and probably top three in the FTSE 100. Gabrielle will cover that a bit more, and we will continue to innovate on climate, including the net zero target that Gavin talked about. And then that is all underpinned, of course, by a series of strong foundations on the things that I hope you would expect around ethics, around health and safety, of course for us, around security, and importantly, around diversity and inclusion. So they're the kind of core focus areas, but we'll only achieve those leadership positions if we do it in a way that addresses those issues on that blue bar on the right of the slide. So, you know, as the UK has become the UK company with the largest consumer base, 30 million consumers, we have a huge opportunity through our brands to engage with consumers and understand some of the challenges they face. And as a big employer, we have, you know, employees volunteering across our organisation. We want our employees to be champions of the change that we want to see internally and externally. And of course, we hope that will sum up to taking BT's reputation even further. So for the rest of what I say, I'm going to focus on digital skills and the challenges we face there and then what we're planning to do in response. So let's start by taking a step back and looking at some of the statistics and then the context around digital skills in the UK. So this one top left is particularly important to me because my kids are just at this stage. So 65% of children starting school now will end up in their first job in jobs that actually are not created yet, that don't exist yet. So the pace of change that we're seeing because of tech, because of the change that needs for services, the change in different sectors of the economy is quite stark. And as an employer and a future, you know, supplier to those customers as they grow up, that's a challenge for us to understand what those jobs will be and how we need to equip people to be ready for those jobs. Second, 11.3 million adults don't have basic digital skills. And by that we mean the kind of five essential digital skills, which is things like being able to write an email and communicate online, being able to transact, so bank or book a flight, and making sure that you're safe and you know how to protect yourself online. And that's really stark. This morning, before coming here, there's a big event across town that the Lord Mayor of London is running about digital skills in the city. And one of the statistics he quoted was that 90% of jobs now need a digital skill. And if 90% of jobs now need a digital skill, what does that mean for some of those 11.3 million who are trying to get into that workforce? So that's a significant challenge. Third, what does it mean then for business? 3 in 4 UK businesses report an internal digital skills gap. That's a big challenge for not just our SME customers, but also our major corporate customers. And the cost of that is estimated at about £63 billion a year. That's roughly half the NHS budget. So you can get a sense of the scale of both that challenge and opportunity for the UK. And that's in the context that Jasmine talked about, around a pipeline challenge, particularly our agenda, and how we get enough women and girls excited about and then engaged and trained and entering the workforce around technology. And that's something that we have a big challenge around, and Candice is going to go into details on that. So these specific points start, they're increasingly well known in kind of government circles and stakeholder circles, but we wanted to understand how our customers thought about it. And so over the summer we conducted some research to understand how people themselves felt about this as customer of our products. And what we found was actually quite different from the statistics, and it was quite an interesting set of insights for us. So firstly, and perhaps this isn't a surprise, consumers tend to not use the word digital. When they do use the word, they tend to talk about tech, but actually the word digital doesn't mean a great deal to them. And in fact, talking about digital skills kind of switches people off. And that's one of the challenges, I think, for a lot of the companies and government programs that are running to improve people's digital skills, because engagement rates are not brilliant. And it's because it doesn't sound like the day-to-day needs that someone has, if they're, they're in their family, helping their kids get ready for getting their first phone, or if they're helping their older relatives kind of get online. They don't consider that in the context of digital skills. They consider it in the context of their direct need. So we need to change the language. We need a different approach to engaging the emotions of people. The second is this question then about control, the pace of change. So because people aren't up to speed with everything they need, and because sometimes they feel a bit inadequate, you talk to parents and some of these focus groups, who are not really sure what Fortnite is, even though their 13-year-old spends a lot of time doing that thing. And that's actually a significant, not just a kind of a challenge in terms of inadequacy of the parent, but it's a challenge about how to then support their child. And a lot of that isn't verbalized. A lot of it we found in these focus groups, you really have to dig out of people how they're feeling about that. And then the third is mindset. And that's particularly around the discussion of tech in the media. And if you think about how tech's discussed and how people think about tech, it generally is considered as one of two things. One is a very successful tech billionaire who's normally male, who lives on the west coast of the US. And the second is then, I've got a problem with my laptop, I'm going to call the IT guy. And they're the two kind of dominant mindsets. But how do we change that, such that people who themselves want to make an improvement can work on the small incremental gains for them to improve their own daily lives? And so this has been really helpful for us working with our brands to understand what is it that people are concerned about, how can we start to respond to that. So we're going to show a short video to bring some of that home.
Frustrating, isn't it?
Tech promises so much. So why is it getting on top of me?
Why do things have to change so fast?
Should I cut screen time? Or encourage the kids to code? What is coding anyway? I'm letting people down. I'm supposed to know this stuff.
We need technology to work for us on our terms, not make us feel like failures. We need digital lives decoded. On human terms, we can relate to. We need to know how better relationships with technology can improve our lives. And we need practical support on a collective journey to help us celebrate small wins along the way. What we need is help. To understand how we can make more as to equip our kids for the new world they will face tomorrow. And to grow our small businesses better.
So we based that on some of the things that we heard from those workshops over the summer, the different types of customers all over the UK. And so another question is, how can BT respond to that? How can we help? And we're keen to help build a movement that helps people get much more out of tech in their daily lives. And in particular, the focus area that we've identified is this group of working parents. So working parents and their households make up about half of the UK population, about 30 million people. They are the kind of core UK consumer, and they really help us. They're really challenged in terms of the things they face day to day. And so if you think about their children, how they support their children day to day, support their learning at school, support their skills, and help them go online, how they help their older relatives and the challenges their relatives face if they can't bank online, if they can't perhaps book a GP appointment in the way that systems are going forward. And then third, how they then in their own work, in working life, improve their skills. How do they actually deliver more in an SME environment where people are very time poor and are very challenged? And that's, of course, that 30 million people, is a household with dependent children, also represents BT's core consumer base. And most digital skills programs at the moment don't aim for that working parent. In fact, they aim in a range of different ways, but they're not articulated and focused in a way that supports that group. And so that's where we are particularly going to look. So if we go to the next slide, we're going to scale up our ambitions and build on what we have in three particular areas focused on that working parent group. So the first is for your family. How are we going to help you make the most, encourage your children to be curious and confident and capable, but also protected? And that's where, of course, the Barefoot Programme, which Liz Williams is in Leeds, has worked with 2 million children through 63,000 teachers, and something we're going to accelerate as we aim for that 2020 target of 5 million. And we're also looking at teenagers as well. So the BBC announced last week they're about to launch an app that helps teenagers understand how to engage in social media and themselves control their own behaviour when it comes to things like the risk of cyberbullying, helping children and teenagers reflect the language that they're about to post online. And BT is supporting that work. The second then is for your business. So how do we help SMEs and our adult consumers grow their business? And as we've started to look at the skills that we need to help build here, it's also become clear that our major customers, our major global corporate customers, also have a need for their own employees in this space. And I had a conversation last week with one of our big global customers who's thinking about a digital citizenship week for their own employees later on next year. So there's a significant opportunity, I think, there to help our customers. And I'll show in a minute an example of that in terms of Google Garage and some work we've been doing there. And then the third on your life is about your communities, your older relatives, and those essential digital skills, those 11.3 million people who lack those skills at the moment. And we'll be working with different partners to achieve all of this. Some of all of these here are working with already. We're going to look at others who we might start to work with in quite a targeted way. And across all of that, we're going to use the access of our consumer base of 30 million people and the presence that we have across the UK through our e-scores and our availability of our people across the country. And so those partnerships are critical to help execute this as we engage with our customers. And one of the ones that we've started working with already is Google Garage with our BT Sport landlord customers. And so we're going to show you a video about what that looks like. Today, we're in Belfast at the King's Bank Stadium, and we've brought the Google Digital Garage workshop to our customers. As we see, the workshop's going on, and it's giving our customers a good insight in terms of how to leverage the power of digital media to make the best of their businesses. As public an experience offer, it's about giving customers what they want and an experience they can talk about and indeed come back to. And that's why BT Sport just adds to that whole package, it adds to the excitement of going to the pub.
Today was a great reminder that we should sell the benefits of what we already provide. It's a great advantage to be surrounded by so many experts and available knowledge. Lots of tips and optimization. It's an excellent event.
I probably am a little bit frightened of the old social media thing and the technical terms. Back then, when we started in 1975, there was a payphone in the corner of the pub, and no such thing as websites or mobile phones or anything like that. Really well organized and well run, and it was a super day.
I think social media is really important to businesses because if you're not promoting yourself, who's going to? Social media is an opportunity to let people know about it, showcase the best of what you do, and puts you in a position where, particularly when you're at games and maybe like the King's Band, of being able to show people at home watching TV behind the scenes footage of what goes on, give them a little bit of extra insight, that content that they crave. And we live in a world of content now, so let people see what they want to see.
So as we accelerate the programs we have already, as we design new programs to work with different customers, we want to utilize the best available global thinking about digital skills and digital citizens. And last year, Microsoft funded the World Economic Forum to do a search, essentially, and look around and understand, with the OECD, who have the best digital skills curricula, the best digital thinking around the world. And they found this and started working with this group. They're based in Singapore, which is generally thought to be the most advanced country in terms of how they train people in digital skills. It's called the DQ framework. So if you think about over the last century, we first of all talked about IQ. Towards the end of the last century, we started to get EQ. And now actually we're heading towards DQ, so digital intelligence. And the idea there is that you map out the different sets of issues that we might need to understand as consumers, as citizens, as employees, and start to equip people on different aspects of that. And so in places we're doing this, the BEFL program in schools helps primary school children with digital thinking. Some work we're doing with the Duke of Cambridge's cyberbullying action and task force helps on cyberbullying. And then some of the security work we do and with foundations like Marie Collins and Internet Matters helps on digital footprints and digital identity and protection online. And we're going to look at how we explore more of these areas, and also as we go outside the UK, working with our global services business, particularly in India, how we build capabilities in other markets in a targeted way. So this is a strategy that we're going to focus on for the next few years to deliver against that purpose. I've talked through digital skills, and I'm going to pass to Moira to talk through digital and human rights.
Thanks, Andy. Let's come back to our purpose to make a better world. So like much of the work that you've heard about today, our focus on human and digital rights isn't just looking inwardly for what we do. We set ourselves our sights higher than that. And this is where we're helping to lead the conversation, both with government, helping them to think about the changing nature of the issues, and also helping other businesses to meet these changing expectations. And these issues certainly keep changing. If you take a look at this quote from the UN Human Rights Council last year, the same rights that people have offline must also be protected online. And you've heard from Andy about people, and all of us in the room, I'm sure, spending more and more time online. The international standards and expectations still apply, such as rights to privacy, free expression, which I'm going to talk about a bit more in a moment. And as the fourth industrial revolution gathers pace, the nature of the threat around things like online freedom keeps changing, and modern slavery too. In a changing world, we need to make sure that what we do is clear, that human and digital rights is embedded at every thread of our organisation. And this slide shows how we do it. It highlights who we can impact, how, and how we address the risk, most importantly, and that we have oversight at the top level, so our CSRD, that you've heard about through Jasmine. And we're about to launch a new human rights policy and training to make it clear what our people are expected to do. And then, of course, due diligence. So that's the very cornerstone of British human rights practice. We do this on an ongoing basis, but also on specific projects where we take expert help as well. And very importantly, we show our approach. We're transparent. So we published our first report on our approach to privacy and free expression in 2015, and our latest report will come out in early 2019. I'm just going to move on to some of these areas in more detail. So first, just to give you a bit of context on why we look at these things. Of course, it's the right thing to do, but we also need to follow best practice. We use the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights to shape our approach. And what do they say? Well, they say businesses must avoid causing or contributing to adverse human rights impacts. We seek to prevent or mitigate impacts that are directly linked to our own business operations. And we must do due diligence to focus first on those material risks in this area. And for us, there are three critical risks. So the first is the right to privacy. The second is the right to free expression. And what I mean by that is obviously the ability to communicate, but also the right to have access to information. And then thirdly, tackling modern slavery. And there's two areas where we're helping to shape the external agenda, the emerging risks around artificial intelligence, and then, of course, human rights and sports broadcasting. Right. But everyone's talking about the new challenges of what it means to be online. We've heard from Andy about the challenges that we all individually face on a day-to-day basis. The issues are much broader than that as well, about how tech companies are using people's data, how online platforms have apparently been used to influence election results. So it's the big issue of the day. So for us, it's particularly about people's rights to privacy and free expression. So for privacy, we can, of course, agree protect our customers' personal data to comply with GDPR. That's absolutely essential. But our customers' rights go beyond data protection. What I'm talking about here is investigatory powers. So that means the access that governments can have to people's communications and data. It's the national security, and of course, it's vitally important. But the government has to find the right balance between privacy, for expression on the one hand, and security on the other. So what role do we play? Well, we're trusted guardians of our customers' data, but we must comply with the law and the safeguard privacy rights too. And of course, we look at these issues at the very highest possible levels within our company. Through our Investigatory Powers Governance Committee, which is a subcommittee of the main board, and our chair and chief executive sit on that committee, as you expect. But we're also guided by our membership of the Global Network Initiative. That's an organisation that's at the very forefront of debate in privacy and free expression, and it keeps our approach in line with best practice. Actually, modern slavery. This is an area where we've been taking a lead, both in our internal policies and also in guiding others. But it's important to remember that no country is immune from modern slavery. And just as a reminder, it's about people illegally exploiting other people for significant financial gain and robbing them of their basic human rights. Gavin's already mentioned that the statistics say that over 40 million people worldwide are in some form of slavery. And that's generating at least $150 billion per year in illegal profits. Even in the UK, there is estimated to be tens of thousands of men, women and children as victims of modern slavery. So of course we've been working our own supply chain and our own business. We've over 18,000 direct suppliers, so it's something that we really need to be on top of. But what are we doing to drive change? Because it's not an issue that any company can solve alone. So we're collaborating with others. Gavin sits on the Home Office's Business Against Slavery Forum. That's a group comprised of about 10 other CEOs trying to drive change in the sector and also create leadership from the top. We're looking at the role of technology in challenging trafficking. We're calling it Tech Against Trafficking, and it's where we've partnered with some of the US tech giants, Microsoft, Salesforce, and Amazon. And then Gavin mentioned earlier, we're funding the UK's first non-slavery helpline. We've been doing that since 2016 when it started. And last year we launched an app with Unseen to help improve reporting. And just over 2 years, the helpline has received over 10,000 contacts relating to 11,000 potential victims in the UK. And now onto an emerging area of risk, artificial intelligence. We understand the risks that AI can pose, but we want people to understand it's not something to be scared of. So right now, AI is very good for complex, repetitive tasks, but it's really not very good for people who deal with that. Intuition, common sense. So we think people will always remain within that loop, what we're calling augmented intelligence. And that's why digital education that we talked about earlier is so important, so we can all be equipped for the future. So what are we doing right now? Well, actually, we have a 20-year history in AI research. Our engineers work with people like MIT, and they're at the very forefront of innovation. One of the things they're working on at the moment is something called explainable AI. We use AI ourselves for network planning, to detect threats to our network, and also to try and prevent nuisance calls. But as you all know, there's a developing debate on this that we're engaged in. So we responded to the government's consultation on the new Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation. I just want to talk a little bit about our leadership in the area of sports broadcasting. So for human rights risk of broadcasting are less significant for us than other risks. That's mainly because we operate in a strong regulatory framework for the Ofcom code. But it is an area where we've been able to take the lead internationally. We've been working with governments, sports bodies such as FIFA and UEFA, and civil society. And with them, we've helped set up the Centre for Sports and Human Rights in June. So the issues are very broad when it comes to sports and human rights, but let me give you an example for sports broadcasting. A few years ago, you probably remember that there was a footballer who had a heart attack on the pitch in the match that we were televising. So the team had to think about the privacy of the athletes, so not showing intrusive footage, but at the same time, I've already mentioned about free expression, the right to receive information from the audience. And that's a really careful balancing act. But on top of that, they discovered that in the ad break that was just about to follow, that there was an advert for life insurance. And so they had to quickly pull the advert and react very quickly to that situation. So I think it's very interesting in a sports broadcasting environment. You have to think about all these issues that react instantaneously. So I think I've explained that we're doing a lot to help shape the external environment. But we also take a broad approach by working with our communities, our customers, and our supply chain. In this changing world, we need to be getting ready for what's happening next. I want to focus on two things here. There's increasing expectation of transparency in this area, and also in terms of legislation. So transparency, you may be familiar with some of the ranking indices that are coming out on CRI, which is the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark, the chain, ranking digital rights, and the Workforce Disclosure Initiative. And then increasing legislation. The Non-Slavery Act came out in 2015, but the government has already announced an independent review. There are similar laws coming out in Australia and Hong Kong and Singapore. And of course, there's the UN Treaty on Business and Human Rights, which I think is actually going further than many people expected it would. So expectations are changing, and we'll need to step up and keep pace. Because, of course, in a digital age, nothing stands still. And I'm now going to hand over to Candy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mona. Well, we've been hard at work for many years creating a more diverse and inclusive organisation, and here you can see how our thinking has evolved over time. Really from pioneering flexible working, even before 2010, but through 2010 and 14, really empowering our people through flexible working and working with other organisations to enable them to do the same, through to setting ambitions, very clear ambitions last year. And we're regularly acknowledged by the industries for being a strong employer for not just women, but ethnicity, LGBT, and disability, and receive awards for our focus on broader inclusion as well. But we do face a particular challenge at the moment. In a time when we are transforming, attracting and holding on to diverse talent can be notoriously difficult. So there are key things I want to talk to you about today are about what we are doing to ensure we retain great and diverse talent, but make sure we keep building that diverse and inclusive culture which delivers the business results in the face of our transformation. We're doing this through holding ourselves to account to the ambitious target set by our executive committee last year, by investing in our mid-level female talent that Gavin mentioned earlier, and I'll take you through that later, to create a pool of powerful female future leaders, and by educating each and every member of our leadership team in the importance of inclusivity and unconscious bias. Today, I'll cover three things on our progress to target, our female development program, and our work on inclusive leadership behaviours. These will be just a short review of our broader work across our underrepresented groups, including disability, our LGBT colleagues, and increasingly social mobility. We will always keep working hard to build a more inclusive and equal opportunities organisation. And I think not just because it's the right thing to do, which has been something that we've believed in for a long time, but it's now very well proven that it's the right thing to do for our business, greater innovation, greater creativity, and better decision making. So, where are we today? Let's take a look at how we're doing against those targets for our female and ethnic minorities in our leadership population. Last year, we set ambitious targets with the Executive Committee, the membership of our senior leadership and our senior management teams. And just for clarity, when I talk about our senior leadership teams, I'm talking about our top 100 leaders. And when I talk about our senior management team, I'm talking about circa 600 on top of our leadership team. We are holding ourselves to account with these numbers through monthly reporting, and each of our executive committee works with their BRs to ensure they are also monitoring those. The targets we agreed last year are 30% for our senior leadership team, those top 100, to be female by the end of 2021, and 40% female in our senior management team. And you can see here our SLT has increased over the last year by 4 percentage points. In order to achieve these targets, we've really focused on core key areas here. Building the pipeline, now this particularly focuses on our female hire and promotion rate, and since setting these targets, to hold our recruiters to account, we've made 60% of our hires this year and our senior leadership team have been female. Secondly, we're growing our capability, and this is about developing a diverse pipeline that's ready to take on those bigger roles when they become available. And again, I'll take you through that flagship program that Gavin talked about earlier in just a moment. But we are also investing in our people networks to help us in that endeavor. We're also focusing on our culture and an environment, and how do we create inclusion for all? And this is key in helping people feel valued, able to speak up, and give their opinions, which really start to drive that creativity and innovation I talked about just now. I'll take you through that inclusion of personal workshops that we're doing with our senior leadership team. And finally, building sponsorship is key to the success of any program, but particularly gaining executive support for diversity and inclusion initiatives has been key. Our leaders set the tone, particularly in times of change. And we've appointed 5 new sponsors to champion our agendas, and they are representing women in technology, our females more broadly, our LGBT community, our disability community, and our ethnic minority population. The key highlight here really is that movement in our SLT population from 19 to 32. Strong progress towards that target, and in addition, we reported this year a gender pay gap of 5.2%. However, you can see from the other numbers here, particularly within our SMT and SST, that we do have more to do. Our transformation will make the achievement of these targets challenging. However, we continue to be committed to aim for these targets and put all that we can in place to ensure that diversity and inclusion is at the heart of all of our transformation activities. Let me take you through 2 specific programs then in detail. And Andy both talked about Tech Women. And it is our flagship and award-winning program. It's focused on the development of our mid-level female talent. It's about 4 years old. It began in our technology division to meet the need to address underrepresentation of females in our technical roles. However, based on the success that we had in those first couple of years, where over 80% of the participants were taking on either promotions or broader roles, we decided to expand this across all of our customer-facing units, and to expand it out beyond just the technology roles and look broader at females underrepresented in different functions in our business. Last year, it encompassed all but one of our business units, and this year, everybody is involved. This year, we had 450 places available, and it was 100% oversubscribed. And therefore, in consideration of the transformation and in partnership with the executive committee, and the potential impact seen, we agreed to offer places to everybody who applied that met the criteria. And this meant, in effect, almost doubling the program this year. The program design has also been updated this year. We've split the program into 2 streams. We now focus 1 stream on a more senior leadership population and 1 on a more junior population to ensure that we are building a pipeline at every level in our organization of great female talent. It remains a year-long program, which includes face-to-face training, lean-in circles, optional modules on things like interview skills and technologies and commercials and finances. And we run that program in London, Manchester, and 2 sites in India, as well as a virtual program for those who cannot get. The results we've seen have been amazing, and in particular highlights, I think, really to pull out this year, as we've got a net promoter score of 94%. 80% of the women who took part said they were likely or very likely to actively look for a new role or challenge of promotions inside the organisation. And importantly, with our transformation, 84% of people said it made them want to stay with BT. We hope to see this positive impact reflected, of course, in our SLT and SMC populations to help us achieve those numbers in the years to come. Let's listen from a few of our participant alumni. It's been a great thing to reel how this year-long program has supported BT women in becoming senior leaders.
The range of modules really appealed to me. They're so different to what I've seen before, but absolutely the right thing for me in terms of where I'm at in my career and what I need to take the next step.
I appreciated the safe environment to practice skills that I could then take back to my day job.
Learning about managing change, networking, politics and power has made the way I work so much more effective.
What I loved about Tech Women is all the additional learning it gave me the opportunity to do. In particular, I like the mentoring sessions It encouraged me to go out and get my own mentor, which I find really useful. It's great to know that our feedback is listened to. This year, the fact that there are two programs running, one for junior and more senior women, means that we can start to build a more targeted development plan.
I was really pleased to gain a place in the program. It really came at a good time for me. This time last year, I wasn't really sure on where my career was going. I didn't have much of an idea in terms of what it looked like or how to get started, so this was perfect timing. I always wanted to be a non-exec, and Tech Women gave me the confidence to go for a role and get it. Over the 3 years it has been running, it has certainly improved the confidence of the women involved, and I know that it's led to a lot of career moves in my cohort, including mine. I took on a new role while on the program.
I now look at my career from a much wider perspective. It's opened up a whole different perspective of where my future might take me and how I get there.
I've learned not to be afraid to challenge the status quo.
You know what? I've learned to just be myself. I think it's really important to bring your true self to work. One should just love to embrace your inner self and learn from it.
I've achieved my objective of becoming more confident, and it's shown with the way in which I deal with my customers and engage with senior executives.
Empowering,
inspiring,
impactful,
energizing,
thought-provoking,
amazing.
And thanks to that wonderful team and that wonderful cohort, we're up for our third award this year, just on Tuesday, so wish us luck. The other key leadership program I wanted to share with you is our work on inclusive leadership. We all have different family upbringings, education, social experiences, of course, and these lead us to have different beliefs and values. And none of these are either right or wrong, but they do result in us behaving differently with conscious and unconscious behaviours in how both we show up at work, but also how we lead others. The Inclusive Personal Workshops are a series of interventions to help our leaders understand their biases, which ones they hold most dearly, and how they impact behaviour, and then importantly, how we intervene with our automatic processes. So the target of this program is to support leaders in understanding that they may be missing great opinions and talents in the teams that they already have by inadvertently excluding people that are different to them. It also helps them understand the mechanics of their team and understand that in recruiting, they may well be recruiting people who are like them, share the same views, share the same upbringings, and result in very similar challenges. And so we're helping our leaders to truly understand the benefits of great diversity, not just of backgrounds, but of thinking. This can build team capability and performance, and we're already seeing the results of this. Finally, this program gives them the tools to lead more inclusively and apply small changes, because it's really the micro changes that we can change that really change how we show up as leaders. And those can make a really big difference. This program is targeted at our SLT and our SMTs right now, but we also have designed a toolkit with team support, views, podcasts, videos, and help leaders at every level to lead more inclusively. And we're also completing a piece of work to look across all of our systems and processes to ensure that no inherent bias exists in those as well. And so, our efforts on inclusion and diversity are seen and recognised regularly by industry bodies and marks of quality, and just a few of those are here. And we hope that all this goes a long way to boosting just our employer brand, helping us attract more great talent, but also great diverse talent, which will help us in the future meet some of the challenges that we will face. But we know that we've got plenty more to do, not just in the areas that we're focused on today, but areas like digital inclusion and social mobility. And that external focus leads me to end on the opportunity that diversity and inclusion presents for the UK, but of course the BT's future as well. And now I'll hand you over to Gabrielle to talk about the last piece of the digital today, what we are doing as a leading telco in fighting climate change.
So, hi everyone. My job is to make sure that BT is and stays the leader on climate action. And we've done some world-leading stuff in this space. I don't need to tell anyone in this room how important and urgent it is that we tackle climate change. And at BT, of course, we have a responsibility to play our part. But we also have a massive opportunity. ICT products and services can help the rest of society to cut their carbon emissions. We have found through a global study that we commissioned that ICT has the potential to enable a 20% reduction of global carbon emissions by 2030. And last year, our products and services helped our customers avoid over 11 million tons of carbon. That's the equivalent of the carbon emissions of nearly 3 million UK households. But that was last year. Let's go back even further. As Gavin alluded to, at BT, we have a long history in this space. We have been taking climate action for over 25 years now. So if we look at the center box in this slide, in 2013, we set a net good target to help our customers reduce their carbon emissions by at least 3 times the end-to-end carbon impact of our business. So what does that mean? We call this our 3-to-1 net good target. So in the 3, we add up the emission savings from customers using products like video conferencing, audio conferencing, or vehicle telematics. So services that help them be more productive, efficient, and cut carbon. And in the 1 part of the ratio, we include the emissions from our operations, those associated with our supply chain, and customers using our products and services. When we launched this target, we were at a ratio of just 1-to-1. And currently, we're at a ratio of 2.2-to-1. So we're well on our way to reach our 3-to-1 target. And the revenues associated with these products and services are £5.3 billion, or about 22% of BT's total revenues. So moving to the next box in the timeline, in 2016, Gavin mentioned, we reached a great achievement. We met our target to reduce the carbon emissions intensity of our business by 80%, 4 years ahead of time. So then we decided to be even more ambitious. We decided to set a target aligned with the most ambitious aim of the Paris Agreement, which is to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. I'm very proud to say that we set this target in September 2017, and we were one of the first companies in the world to set such an ambitious target. And not stopping there, about a month ago, we announced a new target to become a net zero emissions business by 2045. So we're, of course, delighted that our 25-year-old legacy and our continued progress have been recognized. So let's take the example of CDP, or the Carbon Disclosure Project. We're A-rated on our climate activities, and CDP has also assessed over 3,300 companies on how they work with their suppliers. And we are among the top 2% of organizations to be recognized on their leadership board. EcoAct looked at the carbon measurement and reporting of the top 6,100 companies, and this year, we won the top slot. Newsweek has rated us the 8th greenest company in the world and the world's greenest telco. And Business Green has recognized us as Sustainability Team of the Year for our work on the 1.5 degree target, and also recognized us for the work that we're doing on supply chain. So coming back to our net zero target, this slide shows our pathway to get there and the important role that renewables have had. We have been a pioneer in purchasing renewable electricity. We do that primarily through our long-standing deal with NPower, but also through investing in power purchasing agreements for wind and solar. And renewable electricity has really been a key pillar in our environmental journey. And we have an ambition to buy 100% renewable electricity worldwide by 2020. And as Gavin mentioned, just yesterday, amazing achievement. We announced that EU's network is now 100% renewable, and so we're now at 96% against our 100% target. So how are we actually going to meet our long-term 2030 and 2045 targets? There are three main areas that we will be focusing on to get there. Again, on renewables, reaching that 100% target, converting our fleet to ultra-low emissions vehicles, decarbonizing our buildings, for example, through purchasing green gas. And also of smaller impact, we're looking at how we can replace our HFCs, how we can decarbonize diesel generators, and we might need to look at how we can offset the carbon emissions associated with business travel. We've already seen how focusing on energy efficiency has resulted in cost savings. We've saved around £250 million since 2009-10. And our savings have come through introducing more efficient cooling, modernizing our data centers, looking at how we optimize our network, for example, by taking out redundant equipment, introducing LED lighting, and having energy management systems in our buildings. We're planning future savings going forward, and energy efficiency plays a part in our overall cost transformation program. That was an overview of some of the things that we are doing within BT. I wanted to end by talking about what we're doing in our wider network. So let's take our supply chain. This is a key area of focus for us, because when we look at BT's end-to-end carbon impact, our biggest impact by far comes from our supply chain. We found that one of the most effective ways to engage with suppliers is asking them to simply disclose the CDP. And what we're finding is that just by having to think about and report on their activities, suppliers are taking positive action. We're also focusing on innovation. We run a game-changing challenge competition, which is a bit like a dragon's den. We invite our suppliers to come in here to BC Centre. We actually have a session coming up on Monday to pitch their ideas on sustainable innovation and how they can become more sustainable to a panel of BC judges. And one company that has done a lot of this in this space is SGW Global. They manufacture our cordless home phones. And they have, for example, redesigned our range of phones to reduce the plastic use. So, finally, so what's next for BC in this space? We've always open sourced what we do in this area, and we will continue to do so. We're continuing our conversations with UK government and other policymakers, and we do that by sharing best practice. So, for example, in May, I was in Bonn to address a number of international policymakers around what BC does and how BC is taking action in this space. And yes, by the way, I did take the train to Bonn. I always do that. Save my carbon. We also regularly publish blogs and videos to share our stories with others, and we hope that that will inspire them to take action in this space. But, of course, we still have a lot more to do. But thankfully, we're not alone. Collaboration with others is key to us meeting our 2030 and 2045 targets. We're dependent on, for example, the availability of suitable low-emissions vehicles and electric vehicle charging points. And we do, of course, need government support. And finally, I think this is very important and a guiding principle. By setting ambitious targets, we're sending demand signals to the market for innovation and increased provision of low-carbon alternatives. So that was it for me. Thank you very much. I'll now hand back to Andy for a recap and Q&A.
Great. Thank you, Gabrielle and Candice and Moira. I hope one of the things we've demonstrated today is the strength of the experts we have leading these different issues for BT. So what we have... What you've heard today, I think, is a story of some strong programs that actually add up, I think, to quite a lot for BT. If we look at this slide, looking at the different, categorizing those different programs, if we start at the bottom of that slide, we've made some significant impact on cost savings, particularly through that climate journey and the £250 million that Gabrielle talked about. We're also managing risks, both current ones and fast-moving emerging ones, in the digital and human rights space. And those of you following tech stories in the media will be aware of some of the challenges the West Coast tech giants have got with some of those digital rights questions. But above the line, there's also then some big opportunities for us, both in terms of supporting long-term growth. You know, people can have a greater desire for technology and services that obviously drives connectivity, and that's a big opportunity for us, and also drive the skills that then support us in our pipeline as we equip BP for the future. And then finally, on the top right, those 30 million consumers and customers, it's a big opportunity to both retain and attract new customers and attract those the right people to work with us to please those customers. So that's the story of how we're focusing on digital impact and sustainability. That's the end of the formal presentation. In a moment, we'll move to, I'll invite some of the team up to take some questions. We're going to move to Q&A. We'll start in the room, and we'll also go then online. And if you are on the webcast, then you have to click on the Ask a Question button. And someone at the back of the room will raise their hand, and we'll see you there. Or if you're on the phone and dialing in, please press star 1 to ask a question. So if you can get out your questions, if we can invite the professors up here, if that's okay, please. And we have some other experts in the room as well to engage. There is a handheld mic that we have, I think. Have you got one? Okay, first question, please. And if you obviously could state your name and affiliation, that would be great.
Hello, it's David Wright from Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and thank you very much for a refreshing presentation. We're always very used to numbers and profits. It's no offense over there to Mark and his team. But very refreshing, and I think very eye-opening, and they should be very, very proud of those achievements. I guess that also perhaps presents the genesis of my question a little, which is, and maybe a question I think addressed to Jasmine in particular. The incentive schemes for management, I don't think very well recognize so many of these initiatives or challenges. And I'm interested in how you manage that compromise within the boardroom and within the ExCo. For instance, I imagine that cutting staff probably drives the share price up. Cutting retail stores probably drives the share price up. But they're not necessarily good things for society and the wider good. And yet so many of the incentives that senior management are financially levered. So how do we introduce so many of these initiatives into management incentives beyond their, I'm sure, very good conscience?
Okay. Can I? Do you want to respond to it? I was just going to think, just to get some context if I can, and I'd have thoughts on that. You're of course right, but incentives are critical in this. And in our exec management structure, there is a set of incentives, around 20% personal incentives, that is flexible per exec, depending on their priorities. And some of these issues, digital impact and sustainability issues, are allocated within that scorecard. We don't declare externally exactly what's in that for each of those ExCo members, but you can imagine the different ExCo members and their responsibilities. You have that reflected. So in terms of individual incentives, yes, that is embedded. But Jasmine, perhaps on the broader question of what that means.
Yeah, that's fact, and that's what I was going to share. There are scorecards, and I'm pleased to say that the targets that we set do get reflected in the scorecards. So the progress against the targets are measured on a very regular basis. But in a way, what you're also talking about is the market. You talked about the share price. And frankly, that's why these sorts of events are really important. It's great that the investor community is starting to pay attention. I've actually seen a huge shift in the time that I've been on the BP board. I've been on the committee from the early days. There was absolutely, I can tell you, there was no interest in the investor community when I would occasionally go out on IR calls, and I remember going to Gavin on a couple of occasions. I think that's really shifting, and I think that is going to help. I mean, we do align our incentives, but in terms of where the markets are, this kind of thing, and setting out our stall and inviting you to hold us to account on our transparent targets, I think will help.
I think it would be great to see some of those measures, to understand some of those measures more. And I'm sure 20% is probably a level that you would like to raise. It feels like it's the power you guys have to develop and encourage society. Maybe 20% is the wrong level.
Okay, thank you for that feedback. Do you want to say your name?
Hi, it's Carl Murdoch-Smith from Brandenburg, and I'd like to second David's comments. In terms of, I think it's absolutely fantastic that the debate is being held, and I do think it's an area, to Jasmine's point, but it's becoming of increasing focus, and it's great. Today's event is fantastic in terms of that. In terms of that, I've got some questions in terms of kind of reconciling slide 7 and slide 10, which are the way the committee is composed, and then also the Accenture chart, which I think is very helpful. So just looking at the committee, I suppose the most obvious person who's missing from that chart for me was Michael Sherman, your head of strategy, and just kind of explaining why he's not on that committee. In kind of thinking about then the Accenture chart, kind of going from enhancing reputation up to supporting strategy and then leading change. I suppose just clarity, Andy, in terms of who is your line manager? Do you feed up into corporate affairs or do you feed up into strategy? Because surely your role should increasingly be strategy driven. That's question number one. Question number two.
Can I just that one first?
Yeah, sure.
Is that all right? Because there are three ones in there, so I'm trying to have a couple of questions. We'll come back to you. So fundamentally, I think and I'll answer those questions explicitly, but fundamentally what's behind the question you're asking is how do we make sure this is embedded into the core strategy of the business, right, and drives value? And so absolutely, the success of a team like mine and the work that we do is how we work across the business as a series of strategic thinkers helping the business understand how the external world is changing and building that into their plans as fast as they can at a way that, that is cost-effective and that supports the strategy of the business. So we do that extensively. So Gabrielle works extensively with partners across procurement and our tech business and a range of different functions to work with them to support that climate agenda. We've got Dave and others in the room here to support that. Obviously, on the consumer communication side, this is becoming critically important for our brands, and so we work closely with both the brand team and the group, and then what we call the customer-facing unit. So I think the kind of underlying answer, I think, is that it's obviously and absolutely about partnering with the core functions and the core customer-facing units to ensure this supports the business in the right way. I mean, Jasmine might want to address the specific question about Mike Sherman. All I would say is that obviously that the oversight from the CSRD is critical, but the executive committee has responsibility for this just as it does everything else in the business. And of course, therefore, the strategy you've seen here, when the executive committee first was discussed there and then was then discussed at the CSRD. I report to Ed, I would say, with the loss of life to Jasmine. Jasmine, you'd like to comment on?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the sentiment of your question, and just to assure you that Mike Sherman, I mean, this is exactly one of the questions that we push for in the committee. And that we've insisted that as Mike has come on board and has been engaging with Gavin and the executive committee on the strategy, that this isn't seen as something on the side. It's absolutely central, and I'm confident that is how it's being used.
Can we come back to that again? Are there other questions in the room or on the phone? Is that on the phone?
On the web.
Sorry. Can we come back to that? Is that okay? Thank you. Yeah.
So the question on the web is from Andrew Mortimer of Jupiter Asset Management. And Andrew's asking, what are the key hurdles to BT achieving net zero carbon emissions? And could a more radical approach achieve this earlier than 2045?
Great question. Gabrielle, are you happy if I start with you then?
Sure. So I think as I mentioned as part of my presentation, there are some technology innovations that we are dependent on. So, for example, let's look at vehicles. So we are working with vehicle manufacturers to look at what are vehicles suitable for BT going to look like. We're also, of course, dependent on electric charging infrastructure for all those vehicles, and we need that nationwide, which is why we need support of government, other organizations. I think when we look at how we heat our buildings, again, we're looking for innovation, and we're looking for prices to be commercially viable. But I think that's what I said when I ended, why it's so important that companies like BT and we hope to inspire other companies to set these targets, because that's how we see innovation happening. So if we look at renewables, for example, you know, we were a pioneer in this space, and we've just seen, obviously, the demand and supply for renewable electricity explode, which has led to, you know, them being on par with other energy sources. So that's really what we're hoping to do by setting this out. And, you know, who knows, maybe this will spur innovation faster and we can get there faster, which would be, of course, amazing if we could meet another target 4 years early.
Thank you, Gabriel. The only thing I'd add to that, of course, is that one of the reasons we added a net zero target after having our significant science-based target for 2030, a 1.5 degree aligned target, was that the IPCC report that came out at the end of the summer basically suggested that to get to 1.5 degrees, the science was getting more difficult, and we actually needed to see more companies and countries get to net zero, and that was influential in our thinking. And that's by the kind of expectation from the IPCC is by 2050 people need to be at net zero. So actually we are, it's already the 2045 target, a very aggressive timeline. Great, we've got another one in the room.
Yeah, John Lloyd from Jamstone. Question for Gabrielle. Could you elaborate on the auditing processes that you go through to make sure that your energy is 80% renewable? How does that work from a practical perspective?
So thankfully, I have my colleague, Bob Williams, who is head of renewable purchasing here in the room. So Rob, can I just turn my...
Thank you, Gabrielle. Yes, I'll look up. I will. Thank you. So, yeah, I look after the purchasing. I'm looking procurement, looking after purchasing renewable energy. So, some of the key ways in which we audit that are to require our suppliers to declare within the contracts we sign with them that they will supply renewable energy. Behind that is in the UK, with the REGO certificates. In Europe would be the guarantee of origin certificates, and in the States, the renewable energy certificates. Similar mechanisms that allow traceability of energy from source to consumption. There's mechanism schemes behind that provide all that traceability. And we can require audits down the chain to ensure that we get the right supply of the match.
Thank you.
One of the things that I've done in my committee is to ask internal audit to come and present to the committee to give assurance on actually those numbers that we report on, and indeed all of the numbers that we report on in across this agenda.
Thank you.
I'm in a rather unusual position, actually, of someone who's focused on sustainability all my career, and being here with my more mainstream financial colleagues, finding myself wanting to ask a question about the numbers, because it's a bit strange, which I think is a mark of how far we've come. My question is really around about those four parts of the strategy, the four business strategies. You have some good numbers around the cost savings that the energy efficiency initiatives that you've taken have delivered. We had some numbers a little bit on the growth side as well in terms of how, the number you gave about how much revenue now, 22% of your revenue is now linked with low carbon products and services. I would encourage you to do more of that kind of quantification where you can. And I just wondered how you think about the areas where it is obviously a bit more difficult in terms of brand, in terms of talent, retention, and attraction. How do you think about, do you try and generate some business case and numbers behind that, or is it something that was just sort of taken on trust, and so this is something that's supporting those parts of the strategy?
Yeah, let me answer if I can, and I was going to add, but. So I think one of the marks of success of getting this stuff right is fully integrating it into business strategy and operational budgeting and capex planning and then brand planning. One of the downsides of that is that it's then hard to split it out. And so I understand what you're saying. So we take the approach that we try and embed it as much as possible. So for example, you can think of on the climate side, the kind of investments we'll be making in around buildings or in network infrastructure or in vehicles, they're obviously would be towards that zero carbon target, but are replacing existing assets that doing similar things. It's hard to split it out. I think we will see over time, and we'll be working on understanding how these issues, as we communicate more to consumers in this space, help build brand value. But I don't think at this stage we can probably split it out. But I think the point is fine. Anyone else want to? Yeah. All right.
That's an interesting question. I think, certainly in my formal life as a city lawyer, I also cover a lot of our contractual provisions in this area, and I think there's a huge demand that I'm seeing from customers. So again, while it's a little bit difficult to quantify, it's certainly a
threshold criteria, the number of customer contracts we deal with. For example, we are, of course, one of the major government suppliers, and we had to fill out a questionnaire which recently we had about 75% on the flavors. So I think it's completely becoming more important. I think, as I was saying in the presentation, that the expectations are increasing. So I think, yes, more people will need to, more companies will need to be coming on board with the human rights agenda. So there actually, I think, probably, you know, only a couple of hundred globally that fully embrace the UN Guiding Principles. So I think it's, I wouldn't really like to express it in that way in some case because it's actually about human rights as well, but I just wanted to demonstrate that there is a clearly a legal and you know, harder to do.
Thank you. Can I remind those on the phone to press star 1, those on the web to press the ask a question button. Carl, thank you for your patience. Shall we go back to the next one you're listening?
Never something I've been accused of in this building before. As a as boring accountant, I'll ask another holistic question then. Thinking about improving the gender balance in stock management, the most common reason I come across in my own kind of personal life for women choosing to kind of exit themselves from a career is the challenge of balancing kind of family life and work life. Obviously, you know, you talked a lot about skills and development, but at the same time, you're currently going through changing the operating model and consolidating the number of buildings and kind of working environments that you have down to 30. You know, that's going to either cause people to have to move or lengthen commute, or you've got to embrace more working from home. Now, how do you balance that kind of efficiency gains from shared working space versus trying to consolidate the office footprint?
It is absolutely a challenge, and the risks that you highlight are certainly the risks that we're working with in terms of the transformation teams themselves. There will be people that are not able to make the shift that we're asking them to do, but I think the issues around balancing of home and work life has been fundamental to BT's strategy around flexible working, and we remain very, very committed to flexible working. At one point, I've personally done a great deal of data drilling actually on that issue, and it's been increasing concern for not just our female populations, but also for our male populations. Now, something like 80% of our millennials, in effect, say that they want to be able to take time off work as well and also achieve that work-life balance. So I think it's not just a female agenda, it's a talent agenda more broadly about the expectations of people to balance going forward. I'm working very closely with our teams about where do we see potential impacts, what can we mitigate, how do we ensure that jobs and job adverts include the statements around we are open to a conversation about flexibility. All jobs can have that conversation. Some jobs will be more flexible than others. That's just the nature of it. But we are being very mindful, and not just on that agenda, but disability as well. And the adverse impacts of making sure that we're mitigating those as well as we go through that change.
Thanks for the personal protection, Carl. So I mentioned my former life as a city M&A lawyer. As a senior duty bond, one of the four children, one of them has disability, and I've managed to work here flexibly. And a whole range of combinations of home and work over those years. So I think, you know, completely it can be done.
Thank you. Yes. I'd actually like to add a question because I'm on the diversity committee at the Bank of America. The gender balance is of course absolutely discussed very, very, very frequently. One of the discussions we've had is that having the targets, for instance, in the senior leadership team, becomes quite difficult because essentially at those levels you're looking for the right person first and foremost rather than necessarily wanting to meet KPIs. And where we have found it, it's almost the sort of chicken and egg sort of scenario is where we can be a little bit more prescriptive is in the hiring at the more junior levels. So insisting, for instance, on a 50-50 balance when you're bringing in the graduates, I wondered how you guys think about that particular challenge. And also, the other big challenge we have is that when we try and learn about our employees, what people are willing to disclose is very, very limited. I think as they're very concerned with privacy, you know, how even the company may, you know, read those results, etc. And what we find is, for instance, in America, people are much more willing to disclose their race and their ethnic background, whereas in the UK, not so much. I wondered how you're sort of managing that too.
So it's a conversation that I regularly have internally about the merits and pitfalls of targets. We are really clear when we're talking about targets that they are not racist. They are ambitions that set a direction of travel for us, and it is always important that it's the right candidate. But what we do believe is that by setting a clear ambition, we focus the minds on targeting our recruiters to say, no, go find me better diverse talent, not just a point person because of their characteristics. So we believe, and the experts believe, I think, that it sets a clear message that this is important to us and that there are levers that can be pulled, but it is never an ask that you hire somebody simply because they are diverse. We are also, we do have targets for entry-level talent as well. We haven't gone externally with those, but they are in place for both our business badge and our technical badge, and also our apprenticeship hires as well. So we do have those. The other side of things, declaration in BC currently sits at about 60%. It's a conversation that we're having with consulting with the government around the publication of ethnic pay as well, of course. And one of the conversations we're having is the validity of that publication if we don't have high levels of declaration, and how do we increase that. We've had a number of campaigns internally to endeavour to increase that declaration, some with more success than others at different levels within the organisation. And having worked with and discussed with my peers around the business, I know everybody is struggling with that issue.
Thank you. Other questions?
Carl. This is great fun. So it was just a thought that came to mind. I mean, a lot of the talk about carbon emissions and so understandably being about vehicles. Obviously, in the press recently, it talks about the potential that BP is looking to dispose BP fleet. Now, obviously, you shouldn't comment on rumour and speculation. I don't expect to comment on that. However, in any disposals that you may do in the future, I mean, you're looking about due diligence is something that the acquirer does of the business that they're buying. Obviously, you could potentially be looking at disposing the part of the business that is very responsible for a large amount of the carbon emissions of the business. Is it normal course of practice among sustainability? Seller due diligence to make sure you're selling a business to a responsible custodian from a sustainability perspective.
I would say, Carl, that we don't comment on speculation or rumour, as you'd expect. In my prior life, if you're asking a broader question about M&A, in my prior life in other companies, I have been involved in M&A on both sides in that kind of from a sustainability perspective. So I think companies do that. I think what it might be worth is just asking Gabrielle to talk through the things that we are doing and committing to in the BCC around electrification.
So we are trialing electric vehicles. We are installing charging points at BC premises. Again, as I mentioned, you know, we are talking to vehicle manufacturers to ensure that we have the right vehicles in place. We've started also offering electric vehicles as part of our company cars scheme. And again, continuing to work with policymakers and with other companies. And I think that's very important to how we can move this forward.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Last call online or on the webcast? No? Any other in the room? In which case, thank you very much for joining us. I think we've had some good presentations, but also some excellent questions, so thank you for that. I've enjoyed that very much.
We are going to put all of the content you've seen today on the BT PLC website. We'll drop the details to you, and we will also obviously ask you, we'll send out some a form. If you have some feedback on this event, please fill it in. It's super helpful for us to understand what you thought worked, what we can improve, if there's anything you think we are missing, that would be great. And we look forward to seeing you at the next investor event, which we'll communicate in due course. Thanks.
Gentlemen, that concludes your conference call for today, and you may now disconnect. Thanks for joining, and enjoy the rest of your day.